evening. It is Wednesday, March 24th, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Senate to vote today on $2 trillion coronavirus bill after landmark agreement with the White House. The Senate plans to vote this afternoon on a $2 trillion stimulus package that is designed to pump a limited amount of cash into the U.S. economy in an effort to stabilize households and businesses that have been floored by the coronavirus outbreak. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Minority Leader Chuck Schumer announced the breakthrough on the Senate floor around 1:30 this morning after a long day of talks with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and other administration officials. What will all of this mean for the economy? And more important, what will it mean for the millions who are struggling to put food on the table and concerned about their jobs in the midst of this crisis? Is it too little, too late? Well, for answers into this, we turn to my first guest. He's an associate professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Taheed. As always, Linwood, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
We're also joined by an American sociologist and specialist in comparative historical sociology. He's a professor at the University of Albany, SUNY, and author of Capitalists in Spite of Themselves, Elite Conflict and Economic Transitions in Early Modern Europe, as well as States in Power and What is Historical Sociology? Dr. Richard Lachman. Richard, welcome back. So the legislation, unprecedented in its size and scope, will send, if it's passed, $1,200 checks to many Americans, create a $367 billion loan program for small businesses, and establish a $500 billion lending fund for industries, cities, and states. Linwood, your thoughts on where this has gotten as it relates to the Senate?
Well, I suppose we could argue that the Senate bill today that's up for passage today is better than the bill that was originally planned. But it also has some great downsides in it. I mean, one of the things that is better is that there's going to be an expansion of unemployment insurance benefits up to $600 for those who are unemployed. That is up to $600 beyond what the states are going to be able to provide. But the states are going to quickly run out of money. And so we'll find that the unemployment benefits will be less than they would have been. But there is that expansion. So that's good. There's also the idea of oversight of the money, the $500 billion that's going to be under the control of the Treasury Secretary, which is being touted as a good thing, except oversight simply means that once the money is spent, someone will come and write a report. Now, that report will be written by someone who is under control of the Treasury Secretary. And if the report ever gets out to the public, you know, Trump's tax returns haven't gotten out to the public, even though they're mandated to do so by law. If that report ever gets out to the public, then we'll see that money has been stolen, but it will be too late. There won't be any prosecution or indictment of anyone who's stolen money. And so what we have now is a package. The package has been growing. It's listed as $2 trillion, but it still has that meager up to $1,200 payment, one-time payment to ordinary people, to Main Street, while it continues to expand to give more and more money to the Wall Streeters. And so, you know, in these dire times, $1,200, I suppose, is better than nothing. But this pales in comparison, for example, to the Bernie Sanders proposal of $2,000 a month for multiple months. $1,200 is pretty much very little in this bill. I think that adds up to about $250 billion. And so the rest of the trillion, the $750 billion, that's the rest, is going to Wall Street. And so Wall Street is still not only there's an expansion of money going to Wall Street, but this idea that there's going to be, for example, oversight of the $500 billion that's being controlled by the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, is a joke. What this means is that someone will write a report after the money has been spent over how much fraud and abuse the money has contributed to. Someone will write a report. That report will never get to the public, and there will be no prosecution of any fraud. And so just putting an oversight condition is not going to prevent the waste and the fraud in this process. In addition, let me say this also. The Fed has now authorized $4.25 trillion of lending that is going to be money to financial institutions and banks and buying back mortgage-backed securities. So this bill is actually a $6 trillion bill, not a $2 trillion bill.
Richard, before I come to you, I need to ask Linwood one more question on a point he just made. And Linwood, the $1,200, the one-time check payment that is being made, isn't going to last anybody hardly any time. And is it a coincidence that that money seems to be operating in parallel with the president's points about wanting to open the economy within the next 3.5 weeks?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there's this desire to want to get the economy back going by Easter. I suppose that's by tourist time, by travel time. So if the money comes by that time, $1,200, then people will be able to spend that $1,200 on things like travel and so forth, if that's the case, or at least in stores. And then it'll be gone. Easter will be over, and we'll be in worse shape than we were when we started this. So, yeah, I think it coincides with give $1,200 so people can spend it in order to get the economy, quote, going by Easter. But that's a one-time shot, and it'll collapse again.
Dr. Richard Lachman, author of Capitalists in Spite of Themselves, as well as States in Power. As a historical sociologist, your thoughts on where we are right now with this bill in Congress?
Well, I mean, it's going to be better than nothing, but, you know, this has already been said, there are real limits that, you know, most people are not going to get enough money to make up for their lost wages. And even worse, state and local governments that are having to do most of the work to deal with this epidemic are going to see enormous drops in their tax revenues. And the amount of money in the bill to make up for that is totally inadequate. Just this morning, Governor Cuomo pointed out that New York State and City are getting $3.5. That's, you know, less than 1% of this, you know, entire bailout bill for a place that has a majority of the cases and, you know, has been totally devastated. So, you know, that won't be an immediate problem, but in the coming months, states and cities throughout the country are going to find they have much lower tax revenue and they're going to have huge budget deficits, and then they're going to have to start laying off lots of their employees. You know, that was one of the few smart things in the 2009 stimulus bill, that President Obama insisted that a substantial chunk of it go to state and local governments, and that at least was able to prevent them from having to lay off employees, and that prevented unemployment from getting even higher. But, you know, there isn't enough of that in this bill, and it's a disgrace that, you know, members of Congress didn't recognize that. And, you know, it's also a depressing illustration of American politics, that, you know, governors and mayors who, you know, presumably are well aware of this coming catastrophe, didn't have the political leverage to get more aid out of Congress, while all the big corporations and Wall Street, you know, were able immediately to get a bill written and to get help from the Federal Reserve to take care of their needs.
Dr. Linwood Taheed, the narrative was almost that Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi were at loggerheads with Mitch McConnell and the conservatives, and that the Democrats were really fighting to protect the interests of the taxpayer. Even you had Schumer saying, talking about this oversight board and creating a inspector general for the pandemic recovery. Schumer says every loan document will be public and made available to Congress very quickly so we can see where the money is going, what the terms are, and if it's fair to the American people. But to your point, that's really not going to be oversight on the front end to be sure that the money goes where it's supposed to go. It's going to be on the back end. And so that really makes me think that the Democrats and the Republicans, they weren't really fighting over ensuring that the American public got everything it could possibly get to assist the average worker through this incredibly, incredibly turbulent time. They were really fighting over to be sure that Wall Street got bailed out, not Main Street.
You're correct. Look, the size of the bill went from an initial $1 trillion to a $1.6 trillion to a $2 trillion. Now, as it was expanding, as the size of the bill was expanding, and as I said, there's actually it's actually more like $6 trillion because of Fed lending. But as the bill was expanding, the $1,200 one-time payment did not change. That was the original proposal, $1,200, which is $250 billion. The bill expanded from $1 trillion to $1.6. The one-time payment stayed at $1,200. And then it expanded to $2 trillion in the one-time payment to ordinary people. And by the way, it's means tested, so everyone won't get $1,200. Some will get as little as $600.
And that was at the direction of Nancy Pelosi.
Exactly. That measure never expanded as the size of the bill itself expanded. And the expansion was due to more and more give outs to Wall Street. And so as the Democrats were fighting, they were apparently fighting for Wall Street. And I'll say that because they weren't fighting for Main Street. There was no expansion of the initial $1,200 to a one-time payment. And so the idea of oversight is ridiculous. You have a president whose the courts have ordered that he has to release his tax returns, and the Treasury Secretary has said no, even though the law says he must. And so when whatever oversight report is written, the Treasury Secretary will simply say, no, we won't release it. And so the American people will not even know after the fact how much money has been spent on their behalf and given to Wall Street. So if this is what the fight has been over, then the Democrats have lost that fight from the very beginning, and we're only just playing in kabuki theater to pretend as if they were concerned about government spending, but it was simply a farce.
Dr. Richard Lachman, the legislation ensures that the taxpayer-backed loans can't go to firms owned by the president, other White House officials, or members of Congress. That is, I think, a small victory for the American people. But looking at the much broader nature of who is truly going to benefit from this, the businesses that are going to benefit from this, their ability through their stock buybacks and everything to still not be forced to put people back to work. This is not a victory in nearly the sense that a lot of people would think it will be, and I think how it's going to be spun in the media.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. That, you know, there's a lot of focus on Trump individually. Is he going to be able to line his own pockets with that? And, you know, certainly the fact that, you know, if the reports are correct, that he won't be able to is a nice development. But the big picture is that Wall Street and capitalists in general will be lining their pockets. And the Democrats didn't really put up any fight to limit that. I mean, the one big improvement in this bill is that unemployment benefits have been substantially improved, so that
correct.
people, you know, so people are going to be getting a lot more, and that does account for a chunk of the increase from the $1 to $2 trillion. But, you know, as was pointed out, the, you know, this $2 trillion, as huge as it is dwarfed by the $4+ billion that the Federal Reserve has already decided it's going to spend on its own. I mean, we in a sense have a parallel government. The Federal Reserve is able to spend money, to loan out money without getting congressional approval. And, you know, it does it just to help out corporations and preserve their profits. I mean, if they want to pump money into the economy, which they have to do, you know, they instead could give out money to ordinary people. They could give it to state and local governments. But, you know, they've never done that, and they're not going to do that unless they came under enormous public pressure. And so far, that just hasn't happened.
And Linwood, this really seems to be consistent with the trickle-down voodoo economic theory, as opposed to what I know works, which is trickle up. So again, expanding the unemployment benefits, that's great. That's really wonderful. Until you compare that to the benefits that business is going to get and that banks are going to get, and how those benefits are not going to make anybody whole.
Exactly. And look, that $4.25 trillion lending program that the Fed is going to engage in, if my understanding is correct, those loans will be given at 0% interest. The Fed has just lowered its lending to 0%. That means that a corporation, for example, that has loans that are already at some interest rate, let's say 2, 3, 4%, will simply borrow money from the Fed, pay off those loans, and avoid, therefore, interest of hundreds of millions of dollars. And so that's a windfall to the corporations to trade 0% loans, percentage loans for 0% loans. Ordinary people should be able to do that, right? We should be able to take our mortgages and borrow at 0% and pay off our mortgages at 4 or 5% for 0% mortgages. But ordinary people won't be able to use these facilities. This is for corporations and financial institutions. And so this is still another windfall for large corporations. And by the way, the idea that the Trump companies and companies owned by members of Congress and so forth cannot get direct money from the stimulus doesn't mean that corporations that can get direct money can't contribute to the campaign coffers of the Trump administration or super PACs that are supporting Trump, or in fact buy memberships at Mar-a-Lago with the money that they're going to get as part of the stimulus. So the Trump children and companies can't get direct money, but they can and will get indirect money.
And final question to both of you, starting with Richard. Nobody knows what course the economy is going to take, since no one can predict the future. But based upon your experience and your study, do you have any insight into, are we going to be looking at a V-shaped recovery, as Larry Kudlow seems to predict, an L-shaped lapse into a permanent economic stagnation, or the safe answer, somewhere in between? And let me say, I don't bet on Larry Kudlow because I don't know that Larry Kudlow has ever said anything that's right. But starting with Richard, your thoughts on how do you see this recovery that the president is hoping for and that Kudlow tells the president is coming? How do you see it? V-shaped, L-shaped, or somewhere in between?
Well, certainly not V-shaped. I mean, first of all, the virus is not going to disappear that quickly, so people won't be back at work by Easter, or, you know, at best it'll be by early in the summer. So, you know, there'll need to be, you know, another cash infusion into the economy. And as Linwood points out, since almost all of this is going to corporations, it won't do much to stimulate ordinary demand. And many small businesses are just, you know, they don't have any cash reserves. They're going to get wiped out. And so when people go back to work, there, you know, just won't be enough demand to justify putting most of them back to work. So I think, you know, unless there's a different sort of stimulus a few months from now, it's going to be a very slow recovery with very high unemployment and enormous downward pressure on wages. So, you know, this is going to, you know, have a very long-term effect and, you know, probably one that's worse than the 2009 crisis.
Linwood, same question to you. V-shaped recovery, L-shaped lapse into permanent stagnation. And again, I don't bet on Larry Kudlow because I've never known him to say anything right. And he has no degree in economics. So, Linwood, your thoughts?
Yeah, V-shaped recovery could only happen if right now the income being lost by workers was immediately replaced by government payments. The Bernie Sanders plan, for example.
Wait a minute. As in giving more of the money that's going to be lent to business, giving that directly to the American citizen, to your point, as Bernie Sanders is calling for.
Sure. I mean, if you give money directly to U.S. citizens, then they go out and they spend it, and business eventually gets that money. That gets the economy potentially back to where it was. I mean, you have to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. You have
right.
to get people to a point where they can go out and in the public and begin to spend instead of going out in the public and spreading the virus. You have to deal with that first.
You have to deal with their physical health before you can deal with their economic health.
Well, you have to deal with both at the same time. I mean, I said first, but look, people who are laid off who can't pay their rent have to be able to pay their rent. Otherwise they're behind. They may have their houses foreclosed on. And they perhaps will run up large medical bills and so have to declare bankruptcy. That's a prediction for an L-shaped recovery where most of the population is worse off after the pandemic is over than they were when they started. So V-shaped recovery means immediate response to address those economic and financial needs of ordinary people. A U-shaped recovery means, you know, we do this recovery, but we do it more slowly, so the bottom continues for longer. That would be a second best solution, but the Trump administration is not looking at it doing that. The L-shaped recovery means that as people lose their houses, as they lose their ability to generate income, as small businesses collapse and never recover, then this economy never gets back to where it would have been. That's an L-shaped recovery, and I think that's where we're headed with this administration.
Dr. Linwood Tahi, Dr. Richard Lachman, gentlemen, thank you both for your time and your analysis, and look forward to having you back to the Critical Hour.
It's great to talk with you. Talk to you soon, I hope.
Thank you. Folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Trump FDA grants drug company exclusive claim on promising coronavirus drug. As healthcare providers across the U.S. desperately attempt to treat a rapidly growing number of patients with the coronavirus, a pharmaceutical company with ties to the Trump administration has been granted exclusive status for a drug it is developing to treat the illness, a potential windfall for the company that could put the medication out of reach for many Americans. How big of an issue and or threat is this? For insight, we turn to my next guest. She's a pediatrician and medical director of CRC Health and Wellness Group, Dr. Yolandra Hancock. As always, Dr. Hancock, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So just to start off, your first thoughts when you read this story?
My first thought was, what's the motive behind classifying remdesivir as an orphan drug when I know the clear purpose of the original legislation back in the 80s was to ensure that those with very rare diseases still had research committed to them so that they would have drugs that would treat what was going on with them. It was not meant for a company to profit off of a pandemic.
And so that people understand, the FDA has granted Gilead Sciences orphan drug status for remdesivir, one of the several drugs being tested as potential treatments for the coronavirus. So what does orphan status mean? And why is granting Gilead Sciences orphan drug status for this drug a problem?
So historically, when a drug company, a pharmaceutical company, commits significant amounts of funds to developing a drug, particularly drugs for rare diseases, in order to protect them from having competition come in and create a generic in that same product, looking at their formulation of that drug and then being able to make a generic copy of it, so that that would not happen, the law was passed, this orphan drug use, so that companies would be protected from their competitors coming in and pretty much cutting them short in terms of the investment of resources and then their ability to actually recoup the expenses and then generate at least minimal profit for rare diseases. What this does now, placing this drug under orphan drug status, is it allows Gilead to have exclusive rights to this drug for at least 7 years. That means they can set the pricing, the access, the amount of the drug that's available, and it ends up impacting us across the country, not only us as providers in terms of our ability to prescribe it and use it, but even more importantly for our patients, for people across the country who may not be able to afford the drug.
Senator Bernie Sanders has said that it is insane and unacceptable, and we will not tolerate profiteering. Any treatment or vaccine must be made free for all. And also, to your point, it's important, again, to reiterate that you have other pharmaceutical firms that are working on a generic form of remdesivir, but patients in the U.S. could be prevented from buying generics with lower prices now that Gilead Sciences has been designated, or this drug has been designated an orphan. It's making, it is potentially making life an awful lot more expensive and an awful lot more difficult, not only for the people in the United States, for people all around the world. Because with this, explain how Gilead could basically corner the market on this drug for a pandemic.
That's exactly what will happen. It will be a monopoly on this drug. No other country will have access to the ingredients, the components in which to make it themselves. They will be dependent on Gilead solely in terms of access to this medication for at least the next 7 years. And we're dealing with an already burdened system. Our healthcare system might be the most expensive. People argue that it's the best. I argue that all the time. It's not necessarily that it's the best. It's already the most expensive. And when you add additional cost to that, my biggest concern is not only just the cost of it and their ability to drive accessibility and cost, but what happens to patients who don't have health insurance? And no matter what the price point, they're not going to be able to afford it. It's just irresponsible for any company to do that. And it's interesting that the day before this was announced, Gilead stopped the compassionate use of the medication across the world.
I was getting to that. Thank you. See, that's another data point that indicates that there's some collusion here, and I'll get to that in a minute. But explain why that's an important point for people to understand.
It's an important point for two reasons. One, because when compassionate use of a medication is allowed by a pharmaceutical company, one, the medication is used what we call off-label. So this medication was initially designed to help in terms of the Ebola epidemic. It's also been effective in SARS and in MERS, so clearly a much-needed resource. But because it had not yet been proven that this medication was actually effective in like a randomized control trial in terms of COVID-19, they allowed the use of it, quote-unquote, off-label. What they also did was made the medication available to patients without their going through this process of high cost. What they decided to do as of yesterday was to stop the use. Anyone who's applied for it to this point, they will grant. but anyone submitting an application moving forward, they will deny it. And so not only are we in the middle of still trying to figure out what's the most effective therapy, we aren't going to be able to afford it, even in the midst of this current pandemic, because they've stopped the access, because they plan to profit from it.
Now, for those who are listening to this and sitting back thinking, oh, well, I wonder how the Trump administration stumbled upon Gilead Sciences and stumbled upon Remdesivir as this possible treatment. Well, let me tell you, Gilead Sciences has a close tie with Donald Trump's task force for controlling the coronavirus. Joe Grogan, who serves on the White House Coronavirus Task Force, lobbied for Gilead from 2011 to 2017 on issues including the pricing of pharmaceuticals. So there's no accident here.
Yeah, these things don't happen by accident. It certainly does not. When we look at what has happened, even the COVID-19 telemedicine screener, I believe the software that was developed to screen patients that's supposed to be used across the country, this was a startup created by Jared Kushner's brother. So these things, I mean, there are a lot of companies who could have created COVID-19 screening. There are other companies, if given the opportunity, if working in collaboration with Gilead, there would have been access to this medication. When you have your director of Health and Human Services being one of the biggest former lobbyists in the country, who's now directing Health and Human Services, folks run in very similar circles. And so although I'm not going to pontificate and speculate as to why I think these decisions happen, when you connect the dots and follow the money, it's clear how these decisions are being made.
Now, I think it's also important to understand that the 1983 Orphan Drug Act is reserved for drugs that treat illnesses that affect fewer than 200,000 people in the U.S., but there's a loophole that allows drugs that treat more common illness to be classified as orphans if the designation is given before the disease reaches that threshold. So the timing of all of this is also not only very important, but incredibly suspect.
Exactly, exactly. A lot. When you start to peel back all of these interesting layers, it makes it very, very suspect. The timing of it in terms of the number of cases, the fact that they just stopped, they ended the compassionate use practice, the fact that they have just been given orphan drug status, like all within the same time period. These things do not happen by accident. And I think that there should be accountability, both in terms of the company itself and what they were allowed to do, but also in terms of the federal government. The American people really need to be looking closely at all of these relationships and how all of this is playing out.
And there's also, I think, an important data point here from last week. The Trump administration had offered the German medical company CureVac large sums of money. I read in some reports $1 billion for exclusive access to a COVID-19 vaccine that this German pharmaceutical company had been working on. And again, $1 billion for exclusive access. This is just a businessman trying to capitalize and monopolize a pandemic cure.
But I think that anyone, whether it be our government officials, physicians, healthcare professionals, anyone right now who is trying to make a profit off of people suffering from a pandemic should be called to the carpet. I think people need to pay close attention to any of these issues. I'll give you an example. There are physicians. There's a report that came out, and I can understand why they would do it. Physicians, once Plaquenil was identified as a potential treatment for COVID-19, large numbers of healthcare professionals, particularly physicians, wrote prescriptions for Plaquenil, either for themselves, for loved ones, close associates. And although we're on the front lines and are at risk, it's important for each of us to be that better person, to be our brothers and sisters keeper in any decision that we make. This is a global economy. It's a global world. We are all interconnected. And the decisions that are made here in the United States will affect people in Africa, China, and all across the world. So when we're making these policy decisions, these economic decisions, we have to think of the global aspects, the global effect of every single decision that we make, whether, again, as I said, either we're doctors, politicians, public health professionals, we all need to be held accountable and make sure that we're making decisions for the greater good of the entire planet.
Now, you're a pediatrician and medical director of the CRC Health and Wellness Group, which is based in Maryland. And just today, the governor of Maryland has, or over the last couple of days, the governor of Maryland has tightened the screws on physical distance, closing more businesses. Can you give us some insight or your perspective quickly on where we are in Maryland and what you're seeing nationally in terms of these numbers, with the World Health Organization saying yesterday that the United States could become the epicenter of the pandemic?
I can definitely see that. Just over the past 24 hours, Maryland has now 75 additional COVID-19 positive cases, the largest number of cases within a 24-hour period of time since the start of the pandemic here in Maryland. And what I believe we're seeing is the start of the increase of the peak. We really don't know where we are because we're still not doing effective testing. The Secretary of Health issued an order just earlier this week telling physicians that we can only test people in the CDC's identified high-risk categories. So we're still not going to get a sense. It isn't until we continue to increase our capacity for testing that we will truly see what that denominator is. I think Governor Hogan is doing a phenomenal job. People are staying inside. They heeded the warning after showing up at the Tidal Basin. D.C. is responding by having police officers block certain areas of D.C. I think the DMV is responding very, very well, and we'll be able to see that. Not now, because what the cases we see now are from 2 weeks ago. Give me 2 weeks ahead, and we're going to see the effect of these policies in a very positive direction.
And I want to just quickly touch on that point. The reason that you're speaking in a two-week context has to do with the incubation period, and as I understand it, has to do with the amount of time it takes for the virus to manifest itself symptomatically. And so we still don't know where we are with this thing. The physical distancing that has been imposed has not yet had a chance to show whether or not it's working, correct?
Exactly. And I think the general public needs to make sure they hear the point you just made, because a lot of them, as the cases continue to increase, they're like, well, why are we staying in our houses if the cases are going to just increase? What we're seeing is from what people were exposed to prior to social distancing practices being implemented. What we are going to see 2 weeks from now is the impact of us following the guidance or the guidelines of our government officials and our public health experts.
Dr. Yolandra Hancock, pediatrician and medical director of CRC Health and Wellness Group, as always, thank you so much for your time, so much for your input, so much for your contribution to The Critical Hour.
My pleasure.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Turkish prosecutors charged 20 Saudis, including senior officials, in the Khashoggi killing. Prosecutors in Istanbul said today that they had indicted 20 Saudi nationals, including two senior officials, on murder charges after an investigation into the 2018 killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, according to a statement released from the prosecutor's office. Is this progress or a hollow victory? For insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Azar. As always, Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So the Turkish indictment was the latest sign that President Erdogan's government would continue to highlight the Khashoggi case. It charged two top Saudi officials, Saud al-Qahtani, a close advisor to Mohammed bin Salman, and Ahmed al-Asiri, a former deputy head of Saudi intelligence, with having, quote, instigated premeditated murder with monstrous intent, end quote. Your thoughts on this latest announcement?
Well, it's the Turks are tightening the screws on the Saudis, certainly. I think it's quite welcome from my point of view, because I think it's very important that justice be done in this extremely important case. But the Saudi regime is reeling at this point, just reeling. Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince and de facto all-round dictator, is completely isolated. He's turned on his closest relatives, arrested them, charged them with treason, which is a capital offense. Oil is plummeting. It's fallen by two-thirds over the last month or so due to the coronavirus. The country's entire economic raison d'etre is vanishing, and now it's diplomatic isolation, thanks to the Turkish indictment, seems to be all but complete. So it's a very important development.
It's a very important development in terms of putting pressure on Mohammed bin Salman. In terms of the 20 Saudi nationals that have been indicted, I don't see, and maybe you do, any window, and I'll use window intentionally, for them to be extradited to Turkey. Your thoughts?
Not so sure. I think the government's in there.
That's why I used the term window.
Yeah.
And wanted you to respond to that.
Okay, I'm not sure. The government in Saudi Arabia is very unstable, and it's growing more unstable by the day. Now, the future is unpredictable, absolutely unpredictable. Never been more so than at this moment. But if it's unstable and growing more so, then we don't know who will be in power in the coming days, months, or years. And if there's a change of that lineup, if Mohammed bin Salman is out and a new leadership comes into place, then that leadership may try to restore relations with the outside world. And one step towards doing that would be to extradite these accused people to Turkey. So I wouldn't assume that these people are safe and sound forever and ever, by any means.
Is it possible that Mohammed bin Salman, with having accused Saudis of murder and them being held in Saudi Arabia, is it possible that he could execute some of these individuals to prevent them from being sent to Turkey to cover his own butt?
We have no idea. I mean, first of all, Saudi Arabia has never been more closed and more mysterious than it is now, and MBS has never been more desperate or more ruthless. And Saud al-Qahtani was an especially nightmarish figure. He's a man who was like, he's the Iago who was always whispering in MBS's ear. He's accused of presiding over the torture of female activists. And he's the one who apparently via Skype told the people in Istanbul who had taken a Khashoggi prisoner to, quote, bring me the head of that dog. So he's by reputation quite a ferocious character, and if MBS decides that he's very dangerous to have around and even poses a threat to MBS himself, then he may decide to solve the problem by getting rid of al-Qahtani. We have no idea. This is pure speculation. Saudi Arabia is now a total black box, so we can only guess as to what's going on inside. As to the five people who have been convicted of murder inside Saudi Arabia, I mean, obviously that trial is a farce, but what a nightmare for those five individuals who are facing death, while the perpetrators are their accusers. It's an absolute nightmare.
So, Daniel, the CIA has concluded that Mohammed bin Salman had probably ordered the killing, which he has denied. Does the CIA probability statement provide any cover for Donald Trump in terms of his dealings with Mohammed bin Salman? Does it provide any cover for him in terms of it's not a declaration that Mohammed bin Salman was involved? It's a statement of probability.
Well, I'm not really sure how the CIA could have put it any more strongly. I mean, the CIA is not on the scene. It's not a law enforcement body. It can't, you know, can't gather evidence at the murder site. They can just merely gather up data and issue a report indicating which way the data is pointing. So I think the CIA has,
and also this is consistent with how the CIA reports its intelligence.
Yes, and by the way, personally, I think there's little doubt that MBS did it. I mean, I can't imagine this team going to Istanbul without the Crown Prince knowing it.
Correct.
But what's interesting, as you know, is that Trump has disregarded the advice of the CIA, the verdict of the CIA, and is carrying on business as usual with the Saudis and MBS. And that's why MBS felt empowered to arrest his uncle and his cousin in recent weeks, because he knows the U.S. will look the other way. The U.S. has other business on its mind, most notably coronavirus. And so therefore, essentially, MBS has been given a free pass to do whatever he likes. So he really is, you know, he really is out of control. There is no force reining him in. And so he's able to do whatever he wants. The only ones who can stop at this point are the Saudis themselves, and what form that might take, we don't know. By the way, there was a report that someone had tried to poison Saud al-Qahtani. And the reports indicated initially he had been killed, but then subsequent reports said he survived. So al-Qahtani is also a hunted man. So we just don't know what's happening. All we know is that the nightmare inside Saudi Arabia is deepening. And this latest indictment out of Istanbul can only add to the nightmare. It can only make it worse.
Daniel Lazar, as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Always look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Anti-abortion politicians are exploiting the coronavirus outbreak to shutter health clinics. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton posted a warning to, quote, all licensed healthcare professionals and all licensed healthcare facilities, including abortion providers, end quote, that they must, quote, postpone all surgeries and procedures that are not immediately medically necessary, end quote. How significant of a move is this as it relates to the abortion fight? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. She's an award-winning author, international speaker, political commentator, a career reinvention strategist, diversity consultant, and women's empowerment expert. She is the founder of the Exceptional Leadership Institute for Women, Dr. Avis Jones DeWeaver. As always, Avis, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
So, your thoughts on the overall story before we get to the details?
Yeah, it is unfortunate that at a moment of a, you know, international crisis, a global pandemic, something where we really need to have all hands on deck, specifically focused on making sure that we can fight this back as a human family, you have certain unscrupulous actors who are going to use this opportunity to push their political agenda and insert it into a space where, quite frankly, it doesn't belong.
Now, this legal opinion issued by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. It came less than 24 hours after Governor Greg Abbott issued an executive order loosening regulations to help increase capacity in the state's hospitals. So is this a matter of the Attorney General issuing a directive or an opinion to tighten procedures when the governor has issued an executive order that seems to loosen regulations?
Absolutely. It is the Attorney General using the heft of that office in an attempt to insert his political leanings and opinions and positions, specifically on abortion, into a legislation and law, and even, as you mentioned, the executive order that the governor had just produced, which actually literally has a very clear, I would say, loophole in it that suggests that this type of procedure would be something that would be allowed, right? And so the Attorney General has now inserted himself into this situation specifically to push back, to push his pro-life, quote-unquote, agenda, when really everyone's attention right now needs to be saving the lives of the people who are right here, right now, living and trying to survive this global pandemic.
And you also have with this so-called right to life groups, and I say so-called because many of them want to save the lives of the unborn, but have nothing to do with those lives once they are born. They're using scare tactics and lies to support the Texas Attorney General's legal opinion.
Absolutely. But, you know, those are tactics that are normal with that ilk, right? I mean, that has been a big part of their political strategy, quite frankly, for decades, to present misinformation, to act in a very aggressive an intimidating way to lie and try to scare people. That has actually been their modus operandi in every situation, to be perfectly honest, leading up to this. And now they've just appropriated those techniques that they've used for decades in this way. But what I feel what I find very ironic, you mentioned, when you said so-called right to life, there seems to be this double consciousness that's going on right now around this issue, because at the same time that you have these so-called right to life issues, groups trying to lie about this law, claiming that in this moment abortions are not legally allowed, and at the same time that you have the Attorney General trying to insert his political views on women's bodies at this very vulnerable moment. At the very same time, you have the lieutenant governor of Texas who is sitting here in essence saying that old people should just die in order to save the economy. So the schizophrenia that is apparent in these, quite frankly, largely right-wing circles around what is life that's worth saving versus what is life that's worth sacrificing and versus what is life, period, because it is really disturbing to see that they are going to take a moment when we are in the middle of a crisis to insert their political opinion on an issue, quite frankly, that is urgent, because you only have a small window of opportunity if you're going to undergo this procedure in which you can do it, after which you will be forced to have a baby against your will.
And you have organizations in Texas, such as the Texas Right to Life, that says they're grateful that the loss of life during the COVID-19 outbreak will be decreased thanks to the halt in abortions. Well, there's a numeric calculation that can be done. First of all, the Supreme Court has never determined when life begins. And that's really been one of the sticking points for the argument against or pro a woman's right to choose. So with the point that the Supreme Court has never made that determination, for the Texas Right to Life to say that the loss of life during the COVID-19 outbreak will be decreased, that's just legally, factually not true.
Right. It's not. And as I said, this is the modus operandi for these groups. They play loose with the facts, to put it mildly. And it is part of their, I would argue, propaganda machine to use very inflammatory language, to be very, very lack of, to have a very factless sort of language that they often use, and their desire to make this, to make their particular view one that is imposed on others. But, you know, one last thing I do want to mention about this, because I think this is another angle around this pregnancy story that a lot of people miss. In terms of what's going on right now in hospitals, period, because the controversy around here, around this particular bill and what's happening not only in Texas but around the nation, is, you know, the lack of enough supplies versus the lack of enough manpower to handle the influx that we're expecting and that we're already receiving as it relates to people who are impacted by COVID-19. Well, this has created a situation where hospitals are now across the country changing their policies with regards to who is allowed in the hospital. So, for example, normally, you know, if you have a loved one in intensive care, you would have next of kin who would be there with them. That's not happening in many cases now as a result of trying to protect that person. People are dying alone. On the other end of the spectrum, women who are pregnant now will have to go through the labor and delivery of process in many instances without their spouse or their partners with them. And so it is a it would be a very isolated experience. I mean, as someone who has given birth twice, I cannot even imagine giving birth literally by myself. It's just you and the doctor. And so, you know, there are so many dynamics that are connected to this that is personal to that specific woman and that specific circumstance and the choices that she makes upon her life. To have people once again insert themselves into this very unique and dire moment in order to push their political agenda, to me, is especially disgusting when all of us need to be focused on making sure that we can do everything we can to fight back against this pandemic.
Dr. Avis Jones DeWeaver, as always, very well put. Thank you for your time and your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here very soon on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.